Welcome, everybody, to our latest Starfinder Developer Diary. I'm Jason Tondro, your host. I'm a developer of Adventure Paths at Paizo, and I have a very special guest today, my dear friend and colleague, Jason Keeley. Welcome.
Oh, hello, hello.
Keeley, you were in the Starfinder Adventure Path Design Cube before I got there. You've been there since the game, since before the game published.
Basically, yeah, I mean, you know, it was a different spot in the office before the game was published. There was a full, we had an office, a full room to ourselves when it was just me, Owen, and Rob.
Okay.
Yeah. That's Owen, Casey Stevens, and Robert McCreary, of course.
For our audiences, you, naturally, as soon as I start to record a podcast, my dog,
my might bark at any second. We never know.
So we've got Bigby in Keeley's window, and we've got Tess and Otis here in mine, and they're going to go crazy. So anyway,
who knows?
So that was before the build. Everybody relocated.
Yes, before we moved to that side of the to the other side of the building.
Okay, you were over where all the admin people are now.
Yes. Okay. Down on the first floor, and then for a brief period of time, we were on the second floor where customer service is now.
Okay.
And then we moved over. So,
So the first
exciting talk.
I think, if I remember right, one of the first things you worked on was something like Dead Sons 2 or Dead Sons 3.
It was 5. I wrote 4 and then probably on 5. But that was the first Adventure Path. I had been sort of starting with the stuff from the core rulebook and the first Alien Archive and that first free RPG day thing we did called First Contact, where we just started throwing monsters together, and that's where the space goblin was created, essentially.
Is that your fault?
Yes, because I wrote it as a joke, as like, here's some random monsters we can have, like a space goblin and this, that, and the thing. I wrote it for a stream, I think, just to test monster creation and stuff like that, and to have it on a fight, you know, that first that super early Starfinder stream when I ran the Gremlins 2 plot spaceship. Okay. Had space goblins there, and I, it was a joke, and then James Sutter, who was the creative director of Starfinder at the time, was like, yeah, okay, that's gonna be a thing. And I'm like, wait, no, it got away from me.
Since you brought up space goblins, this has come up in conversations about goblins, because there are multiple goblin encounters in Fly for Your Dot. Like, they appear in both volumes 34 and 35.
Great.
And it's partly because it's a space traveling kind of gritty campaign, so space goblins are kind of a natural fit, you know?
Yeah.
But are space goblins the goblins from Pathfinder 2? Like, Pathfinder 2 changed goblins, right?
A little bit.
That their culture has I don't want to say evolved, but we've learned more about them, and they're more well-rounded as a culture, and they're a playable species. And of course, you can play a space goblin in Starfinder too, but they're not in the core rulebook. You know,
exactly. They're modeled a little bit more off the first edition goblins. And if you want to know headcanon, we can talk about the one shot that I ran twice at PaizoCon, where everyone played goblins during the gap when goblins found out that there was space travel. It's my take on how goblins became space goblins. They find a big metal bird lands nearby and they want to get it.
Okay.
They break in, and I kind of was half using Starfinder rules but real simplified because they weren't fully developed. And it was like goblins would pick up a laser gun and like, well, you don't know what it is, and then you want to try shooting it? Yeah, boom. And then, oh, here you go, you've got, you know, laser weapon efficiency or whatever. In the two times I ran that, one group flew the spaceship into the sun, and the other group crash landed on the moon. So that's how goblins became space goblins, I guess, accidentally.
Sure. So I mean, are we considering them like a sort of separate species, like a sub?
Well, maybe just a separate sort of a little bit of an. It's so weird because obviously the goblins in second edition are way before space travel anyway, right? So these aren't the, you know, it's not like these goblins will eventually become space goblins, or maybe they won't. That's the thing about Starfinder and Pathfinder. They don't have to mesh precisely.
And we can always just blend the gap, right?
Yeah, exactly. Something happened.
All right. Well, anyway, didn't mean to go off on a tangent there, but, you know.
That's fine. Yeah.
We think about things. All right, so you developed Adventure Pass for a couple of years. And we did – you developed Signal of Scream. Was that the
right.
first you were lead developer on?
That was the first one that was fully my idea. Against okay. the Iron Throne, I was also a developer on, but that was the outline was written by Rob McCurry at the time. And then I was actually more responsible for finding the authors, I think, and then just getting it developed. Okay. And then then I pitched Signal Screams, got that, and then the next one was Attack of the Swarm, and then kind of half of Threefold Conspiracy, and now coming up soon, Devastation Arc.
The Devastation Arc, and we have art. Go
Let's
to that.
Talk about it. First volume 31, which should be out late August, so in a couple
with
weeks.
A very handsome looking Bantrid on the cover. All right, so let's talk a little bit about kind of how this happened, because Devastation Arc is a 3-volume arc, so in that sense, it's like the other, it's like against the Aeon Throne, Screams. And generally, I think the response to the 3-volume arcs has been quite good.
Yeah.
The 3-1 pass.
People like them.
A lot of people are playing against the Aslanti Empire AP.
And all of those groups have uplifted bears in them, I promise you.
There you go. Because they start off at level 1.
Yeah.
And it's short. I mean, comparatively short, right?
Yeah.
So you can finish it without spending a year and a half in
the Yes. Day. Unless you're doing it once every month or every other month online, like I'm doing. So it'll take a little bit longer.
Which one are you playing in?
I'm running against the Aeon Throne.
Oh, are you?
For people. Yeah. And it's taking a while. We're only just now, about halfway through the 3rd volume at this point. We started it middle of last year, maybe before that even. I don't remember. Yeah. So, take some time. But if you meet, a semi-normal pace, you can get it done pretty quickly. And move on to, if you want to, take those characters, move them into Signal Screams, because that one starts at 7th level, ends at 13th level, and then Devastation Arc picks up at 13th level. So this is our very first high level, goes 13 to 20.
Yeah.
High level Starfinder adventures. People were wanting them, people have been asking them for them, and we're like, that's basically why we did this.
I was shocked, personally, when I found out that we don't even have high level society scenarios.
No, yeah, those have always been capped at a certain level.
Which it just surprised me that I thought, well, for sure we must still do high level society play, but no, we don't.
As far as I remember, as far as I know, with Paizo, like they've never gone higher than like 12th or 13th or 14th, with occasional sort of maybe these special for like characters who are capstone characters, right? They get to play at like 15th, 16th level for a session, and then
I got it.
Then they get retired.
Yeah.
All
right, So when did you decide? Are you the person that decided, hey, let's finally do the high level AP? How did that?
I feel like it was a group decision with me and Rob and Chris Sims, who was with us at the time. We were talking about like what's next. We should probably do the high level stuff people have been asking for. We don't know if we're ever going to get a module line, to be another place to do that. It doesn't happen in scenarios. So let's just do it. And I drew up a proposal about like how can we fit. The fear is Starfinder Adventure Paths are shorter than normal Adventure Path volume. Pathfinder Adventure Path volume. Pathfinder, they're all normal.
A Pathfinder volume is 96 pages.
Right. And we're only 64.
And about 1/3 of each book is back matter material.
Yes. So there was some concern about, because high level adventures traditionally take up a lot more room. That's why you see, if you look at a Pathfinder adventure, at least the first edition Pathfinder adventure, it goes, the ones that do go up to 20, which isn't every one of them, but once they go up to 20, like that last volume is only like 19 levels, 19 to 20, and that's it, right? And there's the spread in the first volume goes like 1 to 5, and then each of the spreads keep shrinking. So I drew up a plan on figuring out how to do that with our page count.
And a lot of the simple physics, because the high level monsters just take up more space. The stat blocks are longer.
Yeah.
And when you print an NPC stat block, they've got more abilities, and those have
gear, all that stuff. Yeah. Starfinder is stat blocks are generally a little shorter, even at higher levels. So we gained some room there. And then I decided to take some of that back matter pages and put them into the adventure. So we have each of these adventures, and the Waking the Devastation Arc is about 8 pages longer than an adventure in previous Starfinder adventure paths.
So for those that have seen an Adventure Path module for Starfinder, you know how this works. The adventure is about 36 pages. And then there's an 8-page article and a second 8-page article. And then there's Alien Archives and World. And so you're just taking one of those two 8-page articles,
right,
repurposing it for the adventure. So you get to, exactly, what, 44?
Something like that. Yeah.
About 44 pages.
Yeah. So that's basically how the sort of talk about the format. Sort of like, we're going to do this, one of this, and there was different ways we could, I proposed different ways we could do it. Maybe we start at 16th and, you know, go to 20th, or maybe other things. And we decided, well, let's go from 13th so you can play pretty much any of the other adventure paths that go to a Starfinder adventure pass that go to 13th level, and just pick those characters and put them into this adventure.
And we did a little bit of a sort of plot hooks for all of those adventure paths. That's too.
True. Yeah. We give you some GM advice about how to tie people in. If you're coming off of, you know, Dawn of Flame, here's who contacts you and puts you into touch with the people who need help here in this adventure.
Yeah. So you knew that you were going to do a higher level adventure path,
mm-hmm,
but what led to this high level adventure path? Like, okay, once the decision was made to do a high level one, now what? Now what do we do?
I'm going to draw back the curtain big time here and confess that with a lot of stuff that I work on, I kind of have a title first. Right.
Oh, yeah.
I get a title that that title inspires me to write a couple sentences about things. And the title is always a placeholder if need be. Right. And then it writes a couple sentences about what that means to me and how that sparks something. And then from there, kind of expand it out. So we had several pitches going back and forth about what's a high level adventure? What does it need to be? We definitely need to probably threaten the pack worlds directly, fully say, like, something comes in. So, like, oh, what could come in, you know? So we talked about some other stuff. We talked about, hey, did we want to talk about the gap in some fashion? Maybe there's some weird time travel nonsense that happens, because that's always good high-level play. What, we don't want to necessarily go to other planes, which is also high-level play, but maybe there is something in there. Maybe, it's, you know, we can dip in and out or something. So we had a bunch of stuff, and one of the ones, I can't quite remember all, a lot of them had to deal with, like, what if this thing shows up in the pack worlds, like a big spaceship, the very much the Rendezvous with Rama or Star Trek IV situation, right? Yeah. Something shows up in the galaxy and causes a bunch of trouble. You have to figure out what it is.
Yeah.
So we started with that, and we said, oh, what is it? Is it a, you know, time machine, or is it this, or is that other? And then that sort of thought maybe write the kind of come up with the words devastation, right? Because it's going to ruin stuff.
Yeah.
And then to kind of really as a juxtaposition, the word arc, which is generally carries life and goodness for, like, you know, sort of, right, you know, traditionally. So I kind of put those two words together and then just kind of spun it off from there. Oh, what is it? Oh, it's the remnants of an ancient warmongering civilization that is thought long dead or whatever is now piloting this sort of arc that's full of creatures in stasis, right? But it's also mean as heck and wants to, you know, wreck everything and be like, no, wait, we want this. Hey, this galaxy looks nice. I'll take it, right? and then that's basically the sort of real broad strokes the plot of this this 3-volume AP. The spaceship shows up and messes things up to a certain extent that the PCs have to save the day.
So did you have, was there any, was the idea of high level IP? I mean, common wisdom in the RPG market is that high level adventures have a very small audience. Like,
yeah,
few games reach that high. And
so indeed,
for people to buy it, and this can impact. Now, Paizo has a long history of supporting their games at whatever games at high level.
Yeah.
We're just publishing Dungeon Magazine. There were always high level adventures in it.
Yeah.
Is that how you were able to get it by? Like, well, we're proud of this is what we do.
I think in a lot of ways everyone was already ready for it. It was basically like, yeah, it's probably not going to sell well. I don't know how often we're going to do this kind of thing, right? 3 volumes is a small footprint. It doesn't take a lot of time and space, you know, as much as anything does. And it will show that we are supporting the game at high level, which is important to show, right? And we'll give that high level content for the people who do want it, and they will buy it. You'll go onto our forums and be like, you'll see any number of people like, where's the high level play? Where's the high level content? Oh, I don't know about this next adventure path. It doesn't go up to 20th level. And then when you say, hey, this one goes to 20th level, they're like, okay, I'm back in, and they'll keep their subscription, right? And granted, it's a very, you know, cynical and capitalistic way of thinking about it. But, you know, if you keep the audience happy, at least giving some portion of the audience what they want every once in a while, you'll retain their loyalty through the stuff that they maybe don't really want. But you know, maybe they will pick it up anyway, and you know, without and look at it and go, oh wait, this is actually pretty cool. Maybe I will run this. You know, so you get them to, so they don't just automatically shut down and be like, I don't want anything. If I'm not getting A, then I don't want any. I don't want B through Z. Look, here's A. Check out our B through Z. It might be good. You might like it.
Here, in this case, we're starting with like X.
Right, here's X. Right, yeah. Check out our A through you know, L, W X. Okay.
All right, so you outlined this adventure, right? Mm-hmm. Full adventure path, right?
Yeah.
And then you recruited the freelancers to write it.
That's right. This this first volume, we can see there. It's not written on there, unfortunately. But this one's written by Jenny Drzewski. Just wanted to put it out. I went in. I needed to get people who would do solid work. Known quantities in this instance, right? This is high level. There's nothing that's ever been done before. Let me get some people I know who have done great jobs writing Starfinder Adventure Pass and other Adventure Pass and other things. So I got Jenny Drzewski, who's great. Second volume, The Starstone Blockade.
Okay.
Which will give you sort of a hint about what might be happening there. That's written by our very own Eleanor Farron.
Yeah.
Did a wonderful job. And then finally, Dominion's End is written by that old warhorse Ron Lundeen.
Now, so taking these three people in order,
mm-hmm.
Jenny is amazing. She actually wrote one for me. She came in and she wrote Fly, Fear, or Die, Volume 6.
Oh, okay.
So
I thought that was someone else.
Maybe I did get that wrong. Maybe that's
I thought that was Jessica Catalan.
Thank God you're here, because
I was just looking that up on Friday.
I'm already making dumb mistakes already. But okay. all right, so maybe I think of some of the Backman articles she did for me.
But she might have.
So Jenny's fantastic, and then Eleanor is a Pathfinder developer.
She is. Yeah.
I miss The Office, man. I miss going in and seeing everybody every day.
Yeah. It'd be nice to see some people, some of these good people.
And Ron is like a one-man publishing company.
Yeah, he's markers.
Anyway, all right, so...
Each of these authors, I had had written, ironically, a volume and a three-volume adventure path previously. Jenny Drzewski wrote the second volume of Signal of Screams, which I am attempting to remember the name of as I am talking. Okay. The Diaspora Strain... I remember the first one and the third one. I cannot remember the second one. Penumbra Protocol. Yes, sorry, you're cutting in and out. Okay, yeah, the Penumbra Protocol. And then Eleanor and Ron both wrote for Against the Aeon Throne.
Okay,
so reversed though, Ron wrote the first volume and Eleanor wrote the second.
Okay, all right.
So I knew that they could write volumes for, you know, I knew that they were accomplished Starfinder Adventure Path writers.
Yeah,
I knew they could do it. There's all sorts of good stuff in all of these that goes does some stuff. As I was sort of teasing, I think over talking over the Gen Con streams, that the second volume's got an angel on a motorcycle and a giant park come to life. The first volume's got some crazy weird undead. This cool daemon. And the third volume is just the. I just want to explain the first third of the third volume. I really want to get in. I want to spoil that, but I'm not going to spoil it completely.
Okay.
Because that's, I want people to check. I want people to see that. And I want people to get the first two volumes first and get excited before they hear what everything. I feel like a lot of stuff I do just goes off the rails in weird ways that probably aren't expecting.
That's the Jason Keeley jaunt, right? Like, John,
yeah.
That's what you do. Yeah. I remember you talking, I think on this same show, where you were talking about Attack of the Swarm, and you were like, I kind of inherited this war story, plot line. I'm not real big on war stories, and I'm paraphrasing you.
Yeah, no, that's what I said.
So I made it go weird. Like, I made it, and we're like inside the swarm's mindscape and all kinds of.
Why not? It's got to go weird.
But that's good. Starfinder lends itself to these gonzo kind of storylines where everything is, I love it because it makes the adventure sort of mind-bogglingly fantastic. Like, in the literal, not fantastic as in the sense of good, but fantastic in the sense of holy crap. Like, that kind of mind-blowing example is exactly what this game is good at. And you bring that. You bring that.
Because, you know, my influences in terms of, like, science fantasy are, you know, the weirder, the better, I think, you know.
Okay.
The first thing that comes to mind is always is I say I want Starfinder to be as Farscape-y as I can make it.
Okay.
And some of that stuff got weird. Some of the stuff was pretty, you know, normal, especially the first couple seasons. But then, you know, there's some weird Mindscape stuff that happens, I think, in at least one or two episodes, right?
Well,
they get shrunk about one episode, you know.
That's a good opportunity for us to segue into the idea of influences on this AP.
Mm-hmm.
We can tell from the Starstone blockade and your observations about kind of this big, the Ark invading, that there's an invasion plot line.
Basically, yes.
It's a big sort of fleet or armada coming in it's a big giant. In science fiction, this is often referred to as the big dumb object, the BDO.
Yes.
Right? A big giant, like a monolith from 2001, or two examples which you already named, the Rama from Arthur C. Clarke's Rama, or the alien probe in
Star Trek 4. Or if you're a crusty old video gamer like myself, there's a text adventure called Starcross, which is basically you're a down in your luck space miner looking for objects, and you stumble across this huge thing that you get on, and you've got to solve all the puzzles and take it back to the to Earth to win fame and fortune.
Right on. All right. So, what are there other influences that you brought to this outline or to the AP in general?
There's influences. There's sort of some of that sort of I can't think of an exact influence, but the very first volume is actually kind of less about sort of what does happen back at the Pack Worlds and more about like how the PCs kind of like are involved at the very beginning, right? They kind of actually, to spoil it a little bit, they're partially the reason why this thing shows up.
Nice.
So it makes, again, that's the sort of thing to think about with high-level adventures is that the PCs have a lot of agency and can do a lot of stuff. They're very important people at this point, 13th, 15th, 16th, a level. So they should be treated as such. And in the second volume, there's some of that. You get to talk to the Pack World's government and be like, this is what I think we should do. And they're like, help us direct our fleets so we can fight off this, these bad guys so good. And, and then like you get sent. And it's like, you're the only ones who can do it. Get onto that object and put it, turn it off.
We're not just space cowboys anymore. We're the elite. We're General Solo. We've all been promoted.
There's a little bit of I guess for influence wise, there's a little bit of a trench run situation at the end of the second volume, although that's more on foot than on a spaceship. That's something that I had in mind heading that. And then there's also a dragon because it's science fantasy. And then the third one is very much has a lot of influence in. This will give it away, so I'll say it anyway. There's a little bit of a Matrix-y kind of influence there on part of it.
Okay.
There's something else that I was thinking about. The other one's just sort of getting around the spaceship and
I'll tell you what it reminded me of as I was reading it.
Hmm.
But this will also help give it away. And that it reminded me of Pleasantville.
Yes. There's a little bit of that in there. There's a little bit of that one part of Fallout 3, which is a little bit like Pleasantville.
Okay.
And
All right. You'll have to pick it up. My hope is to have Ron on to talk about that adventure.
I gave him quite an assignment to do. Ron, I don't know how this is going to work. Write it. And he's like, sure thing.
Well, this is something that we both have done, right? Like we have both, and I experienced this when I was writing Fight for Your Die. I had really complicated sort of set pieces. Mm-hmm. And I didn't know for sure how to pull it off in a way that was plausible, that didn't railroad the players, and that gave the players all something to do. But I'll tell you, we pitch these fastballs to the right freelancer, and they just hit it out of the park. I mean, it's fantastic what they do. And I don't, what would we do without them? You know, I don't even
know. Yeah. No, it's. That's the benefits a little bit to being the producer and in a lot of ways director of these sort of things, to be like, give the writers/actors or whatever something challenging as heck, not really sureing how it's going to get done. Maybe you've got a general idea because if it doesn't turn out, you kind of know how to fix it maybe, but just sort of like giving them the freedom to go and take it because I think these things benefit a bit when we have a lot of minds sort of thinking about the plot and the individual encounters and all of that. It just you get a lot more voices basically, right? And that's always good.
And this has been a challenge, because I come from academia where you design your class. I mean, you can always solicit outside opinions and you can do a bunch of research and see what other people have done. But ultimately, it's you in your office, you know, doing your own thing. And there's a lot of kind of emphasis put on the autonomy. Like professors take pride in the fact that they have that academic freedom and they get to call their own shot, right?
Yeah.
And it's very different than what we do. What we do is very much of a group exercise, you know, and we all kind of get together in the room and we throw ideas around and we whiteboard it and we revise a lot. You know, there's a lot of stages of, I mean, it goes from you write the outline, but then Rob McCreary has to approve it.
Yeah.
And that might involve referring stuff up all the way up in the chain to Eric.
Right. I say even before that, we're bandying ideas. Like what is this plot point? I know we've got to get to plot point C, but how do we get there? Right. And it's you, me and Rob always sort of thinking about like, what is that? What is the thing that needs to happen? And we'll eventually maybe come up with something. That was a big challenge actually, because it was just me and Rob working on the pre-outline version of Devastation Arc, which is why basically. I'll actually bring up the cover up again because I want to say that this is both these parts of the cover are by Ben Wooten, and you can see again. You said him on the front. This Bantrid.
Bantrids, yeah.
Bantrids were something that I wrote as a freelancer for the Pack Worlds thing. I was asked to write the weird alien species, for whatever that is. And in doing so, I had also proposed that there were just a wheel at one point, and that was too weird. So I just gave them a trackball at the bottom, a floor, basically, right?
Yeah.
All this being said, Pack Worlds is also the book that has the seven armed jellyfish with eyeballs on their elbows, which is somehow not the weird one. this is the weird one, but obviously that one's way weirder. But these little guys I just said, they've got to be, you know, basically from the Pack Worlds because it's the book of the Pack Worlds. So I had to sort of create this reason why we hadn't seen anything like this before. Going over that, just sort of, they just sort of showed up on this moon. Maybe they were in stasis. They have no memory of who they were. Any of their cultural heritage is just basically gone. So they're starting over from fresh new. And so I like them because I wrote them, because I'm, you know, narcissistic in that way a lot of times. But Rob took to them as well, because at one point he was playing one in our sort of, Starfinder After Hours game, which only went on for a couple months, but he was playing it and he was enjoying them and he just loved them too. So we were just sort of thinking about like, okay, this is a high level venture path. Obviously it's going to be a threat to the Pack Worlds, but maybe there is a mystery, a big setting mystery we should also solve.
Yeah.
And we don't want to obviously solve the gap that's too big. So let's think of a smaller, but also big. And then we both sort of eventually came to Bantrids. They have a history, but no one knows what it is. Let's answer that question.
Yeah.
So that's basically how the Bantrids sort of came about. being in this crazy high level adventure, and you do kind of have to go to their home moon, and it turns out it's something else. It might even be a world seed, shut down some stuff so the moon doesn't completely melt and destroy their home. But you also find out who they were millennia ago, and it's a sad story, to be sure. Hopefully it'll make you love these little wheelie noses all the more.
And we have the Back Matter article is on their
moon,
and there's a lot of development of the locations and what it's like to be there, and also there's a bunch of player options for Banjo.
Sure.
You can modify your wheels so you can roll up walls, or you can, you know, do all other kinds of crazy stuff with it. So because Banjos need to be even more strange. There's a couple of really colorful NPCs too, because when you look at a Banjo, you're like, well, how are Banjos different from one another? Well, let's show you, because there's a bunch of great art in here of like a, you know, sort of gypsy, not a, like a kind of you know, Hawaiian shirt wearing Banjo who, like, you know, hangs out at the at a bar, I think he tends bar.
It's good. All
crazy thing. So anyway, lots of cool stuff in here.
Yeah, this one's got a cool racing stripe on his orb, and that's how we also gave them like a necklace, essentially, right? So how to tell them, make them different, put clothes on them somehow.
Yeah, put some kind of accoutrements on them.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't know, those tentacles look like they could wear a ring. Like you could put on those things. Yeah.
Several, maybe connected with little chains and stuff. Yeah.
Now that you pointed out, they do look like giant noses with a wheel. You're right, they are.
Yeah. Yep, we've called them that all the time. And we make that joke during the games, and Rob would be like, no, I'm not a nose. I'm like,
now I want to put a big, giant Groucho Marx mustache on.
Yes, I'm Mr. Nib.
All right. Anyway,
that's just Banter spelled backwards.
All right. So, how did the development process go? Like, what I'm curious about is challenges that you found along the way. You've never done a high level adventure path before. How did that go?
I had never done a high level adventure path before too, so it was a voyage of discovery. Trying to find out all of our high level creatures and what existing high level creatures there are. And at this point, we still have three alien archives to pull from, and there's some good stuff, but a lot of them are like they're all gargantuan or colossal. Anything that was like and granted that's fine for, you know, a couple fights, but I didn't want to wear off, you know, and map size is important too. You know, you want to fit a map on a half piece of paper, right? And everything is just, you know, 30 by 30 feet. You're going to fight in two of these, even though that is technically a CR a correct encounter, right?
Yeah.
It was just too much. And I had to think of ways to find other creatures that were different sizes, and then come up with some ideas for other creatures. And that was a lot of the talking to the adventure author freelancers and the other freelancers. Like, I want high level creatures. They also, the stat box do have to fit on one page for the alien archives in the back. So, I want to get some high level creatures that are small or medium sized or
large size design, you know, like you kind of need, you need like a boss dude. You need some kind of spellcaster. You can have like a line infantry minion dude.
Yeah.
Maybe they have a pet animal or two, and then and maybe one of those can be giant big, but you don't want, like, most of them have to be kind of ordinary medium or small, mm-hmm. so that you can throw multiple of them up against the players in a hallway and make it a playable fight.
Yeah, an interesting fight in some fashion. Yeah. So that was a challenge. There are some, you know, still some big things. You know, we still got a big park come to life. That's a gigantic thing. But that should feel like that because you're fighting an entire park. Some big giants actually show up near the third volume. Some semi-familiar giants from Pathfinder 2, moon giants and eclipse giants and that kind of stuff.
Oh, so those are put it over then.
Yeah, yeah, we ported some stuff over too. Right. This is the three volumes where I think it might even be this first volume that has the Death Cruiser in it, which is one of my another thing was sort of ported over, but you know, Starfindered it up a bit because you know, sure, you know, there's a, you know, the myth of the coach that drives itself and a fantasy thing or has ghostly drivers or whatever still is good, but we still, you know, we have, you know, Christine and Nosferatu, right? These cars that are evil and drive themselves, right? They're cars, though, right? And so I wanted to sort of make that part of the future too.
Okay, what was the Stephen King movie where all of the trucks?
Maximum Overdrive.
Maximum Overdrive. That's right. Yeah.
that great. That he's got a great cameo in that one, which I, for family reasons, I won't repeat what he said. But the ATM calls him a swear word, and he's just like, "Honey, this ATM just called me a swear word." Not the greatest actor in our of our generation, Stephen King, but sometimes it's just fun to see him on the screen sometimes.
Well, he and M. Night Shyamalan can share their
yes, opinion. Exactly.
Yeah. So I remember when we were sitting in the cubes one day, and Ron came over, and he started because he was working on the third volume, and he started to explain to us some of the unexpected challenges.
Yeah.
Starfinder play.
Yeah.
Can you walk us through some of those?
Yeah. At the very high levels, you know, 18, 19, 20, there's the DCs of things get to be a point where it's tricky, like, because our operatives are so good at skill usage that he was like, I wish we could have one set of DCs if an operative is trying something and then a much lower number for everybody else for it to be fair. And I'm like, no, I get that, but, you know, we stick with the numbers and there's some stuff in there that he's managed to put into there that are actually like, if you do this, you get this kind of like semi alternate capstone thing. If you're a biohacker with this, you know, this capstone, you can do it an extra time a day or something like that because you've done this thing. So he really played with all the high level stuff because he's to do, but the DCs can get out of hand.
The closest I got to writing this was when I did Assault on the Crucible.
Right.
Right, which is the last volume of Dawn of Flame. And I remember thinking that what makes a high-level adventure work is to not fall into the obvious trap, which is making all of the player characters' high-level abilities that would derail your adventure not work.
Yeah.
Don't say, no, that... You can't teleport. You can't go in. You can't walk through walls. You can't cast. You can't use a divination to get a complete map of the facility. Like all of those things that high level characters can do, you can't impersonate the bad guy perfectly for 24 hours. Right. But when the player characters do that, it can be very tempting for the GM to say, "Oh, that doesn't work. We've got anti-teleportation fields. What's the Star Trek thing that they say that when you can't use a transporter somewhere?
Oh, anyway, gosh, I don't.
Kind of jammer, or whatever. So we can't use the teleporters. So no, you can't do that. That's bad adventure design. Instead, write it so the players have to use those abilities to succeed. Like the adventure is impossible to win if you don't. If you don't get a complete map of the facility with your arcane, with your scrying eyes, if you don't impersonate the boss for 24 hours, you know,
right.
If you don't teleport instantly right to the secret place, you know,
right, it comes hard.
And that let the players not just allow the players to do that, but make it so they have to do that to win. And I guess I'm curious about sort of your thoughts on that, like how.
Luckily, Starfinder's high-level stuff isn't as high-level as the Pathfinder high-level stuff in a lot of ways, right? Because we don't have the ninth, eighth-level spells, right? So we don't have to necessarily worry about... We don't wish and Miracle still... At some point, Technomancers and Mystics will be able to do stuff like that, but that's like at the very, very end.
Well, wishes are watered down from regular wishes.
Yeah, and that's too. So it's a little easier to sort of keep that in mind. There's the, you know, there are the limitations of these things too. Like teleport is a great spell, but if you know where you're going, yeah. If you don't know where you're going, you kind of can't do it. I mean, that's written in the rules. You just can't go wherever you want.
Yeah.
Or if you do, things might go terrible for you.
Yeah.
So you know, all that stuff is baked in to the game in a way that it was a little easier to keep track of. But like I was saying, there's that weird trench run. There are a certain amount of, like, I guess, quote unquote railroading that you do need to do in a way, like, oh, they get to the, you know, the surface of the giant spaceship, but in the process, their ship either crashes or they don't know where to go. So they have to land here because of all the anti-aircraft fire, that it's just easier to go on foot. Yeah. But that going on foot, if you can, if you just do a series of, you know, skill checks, you can get across the surface of the thing as other spaceships are crashing into it and lava is, you know, getting the metal is getting melted, or, you know, electricity is just arcing across the thing. But if you know, I've written in, you know, got to keep in mind, if someone can teleport, then they basically succeed at X number of challenge, you know, X number of skill checks immediately, automatically, because they spent the resources to.
Sounds pretty epic. I mean, running over the surface of the Death Star sounds pretty
epic. I mean, that's the sort of the idea that I wanted to get out of it, right? Yeah. And then you fight a dragon at the end.
So you finished all of these adventures some time ago.
Yeah, it's been a few months now, hasn't it? Pretty much, prior to the Quarren jail. I finished developing. They were getting laid out though at the beginning of all of this, so that third volume, I think I had to copy fit from home or something like that. But they're all done. They're all sent to the printers, and they all look awesome. And each one more epic than the last. I'm excited for people to try to start getting them, looking at them, and letting me know if this is the high level stuff that they want.
The first one comes out this month.
Late August, I think.
Late August. Okay.
Yeah.
Do you have a chance? I guess I'm just kind of curious, like how we can get feedback on this. I'm like you. I'm very curious to hear what people think about it.
Yeah, if you say that, you know, if you're out there listening to this now or watching it, and you get it later, you know, write a review on our site. I check out the reviews at the very least for the products that I've worked on, whether they be good or bad, occasionally lurk in the forums for things.
You're on Twitter as Hers Weston.
Yes, you can find me on Twitter at Hers Weston, and at me. Though keep it civil, please, I would say. Right?
Yeah.
A lot of people did a lot of, you know, it's a lot of hard work to make one of these things. And, you know, we don't always get it 100% right. There's stuff that I would probably maybe have thought about changing if I had had more time at the very beginning, right? It's always the trick. It's like, Rob and I had to kind of get this going quicker than we thought we needed to. And then, and it's a couple points we were banging our heads up against ideas that we just weren't working. Yeah. But I think we came up with some good stuff, and all of our authors delivered. Kudos to them. And, you know, it's a lot of work. So.
Can you share some of those conversations about about some of the problems that you were running through?
Sure. It was just that, I mean, it's the same thing. It's like, you can have ideas, you know, everyone can, you know, just generate ideas. But it was just like, we weren't excited about any of them at the beginning, right? We're just like, oh, they did this and this. Well, yeah, that's okay. But how do they get here? And like, what, it was kind of like the general idea of like, this thing shows up and attacks the pack world in of itself didn't sustain three volumes of adventures, right?
Yep.
It needed to have some stuff a little bit around it and stuff in it. I kind of knew what I wanted to happen in the third. Eventually came to this idea of what happens in the third volume, which, again, not quite spoilering. But had to have that second volume be all the stuff that the PCs have to run around. And that's the sort of thing to talk about high-level adventures. You can tax the PCs a lot more. Like, this second adventure just kind of happens, and it doesn't stop happening. And whether or not your PCs decide they want to take that 10-minute break, that precious 10-minute break to get their stamina back, that actually has major consequences. Someone might get hurt. Someone, you know, something. When you get to this part, it's harder.
I love that. Long ago, I'm gonna make a terrible mistake, and I'm gonna talk about one of my old games. I designed what I called my 24 campaign.
Hmm.
Back in third edition D&D, 3.5 actually. Remember that thing with the handbook where you could play characters over level 20?
Yeah.
So every PC was 24th level.
Okay.
We played 24 sessions. Each session was 1 hour of game.
Mm-hmm.
So it's the entire campaign is one day.
Right.
You never get spells back.
Wow.
Right?
This
of course, you cheat. There's a couple of ways in there for me to cheat, right? So that you can get your spell back in time for the final battle. But But the idea of like, okay, but to get back to your point, like you can put just encounter after encounter after encounter, and when they're 13th, 14th, 18th level, you know, let's put them through the ringer. Let's let them really show what they can do.
Yeah.
And I love the fact that you've got consequences for those 10-minute reps.
Yeah, that was. I mean, you know, I'm not going to take credit for that. That was all Eleanor who decided, like, okay, this is going to. You know, you put a little sidebar up there for the GMs, and be like, hey, GMs, this is about to be real tough for the PCs. Just so you know, they're not going to get to rest, pretty much, because this is a space station that is essentially. Has no power anymore, and you know all the stuff that happens then, and all the people who take advantage of when that happens, and it makes it So going back to talking about, well, Rob and I were, I can't quite remember any of the stuff that we rejected, but it was just generally just kind of like we'd sit there, and this is why I think having more voices helps, right? If we had a third person that or a fourth person, that sort of triangle of minds would have eventually worked at it at a different angle than Rob and I were kind of coming at it at the same angle over and over and over again.
Yeah.
Until we there were multiple times where we would just be like, okay, this, we spent an hour, we haven't gone anywhere, let's meet again tomorrow. And that just becomes the unfortunate reality when you need to have something, you know, to sell.
Yeah.
You gotta hash it out. And eventually we got to a point where I could write the outline and then show it to him. And again, the usual tweaks happen. And that was it.
I remember once I'd only been on the job for maybe a month or so, and you were working on one of the three core conspiracy modules.
Yes.
Convention. And you were like, Jake, I need your help with something. And we went into the breakout room, and you were like, okay, here's my encounters, right? And I can't figure out how they get from here to there. And really, all you really needed to do was talk it out loud. I didn't know how to do anything. But I was there as an audience for you, and we kind of figured out like where it all connected, and we figured out the part that was maybe the weaker elements that we could throw out and what maybe didn't make sense. And we brainstormed a little bit and we solved it. And then I got the exact same thing reversed when I was working on the first round of Fly, Fear, Die. And I'm like, shit, I don't know how to do this thing. I have this cool like mountain chase scene, right?
Where
they're like driving their truck up the mountain and they're fighting off flying hover cars and all kinds of stuff going on. But I couldn't figure out how to get them there. Like I had this set piece I wanted, but how do I get from A to C? And it's so invaluable. Like we can't do this job by ourselves. I mean, we can, it wouldn't be as good.
Yeah. I mean, there are people who probably can, who have done like some great minds out there who can sit down and really work out all the puzzle pieces and put out a terrific product. I think personally, I just need every once in a while to be like, what am I doing? Okay. That's what I'm doing. Great. Okay. Got it. And then head off.
Yeah.
Just sort of worry at it like a dog, for a little bit.
It helps. I mean, you're right. We could solve it, but it would take me, for example, it would take me a lot of time.
Yeah. Time is important too.
Yeah. And, like, you know, it's hard. Like, I like to work on things when I get a good idea for them. And so to do that, I move all over the project. Like, I get a good idea for chapter 8, so I start working on chapter 8. And then when I get a good idea for chapter 3, I'll skip back and I'll work on chapter 3. Well, that's great when I'm a third-party publisher. But when I'm working on something that's got a production schedule,
yeah,
you got to write chapter three now.
Yeah, I mean, that's fair. Like, it, yeah, having, or yeah, because you don't have chapter eight yet from the freelancer because
yeah,
the deadlines have to be a little bit later. Yeah, 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 that can hurt. That is the thing to note, and I don't know if this will ever become handy for you as you're going, because you're, you know, halfway done developing for After Your Life. But like, once you get to the part where like, oh, that's way better, I should do something earlier that foreshadows that, or change the name of this person because I realize that all the names I have start with X or something like that. Right.
Right.
Yeah. I did that for Threefold. I went and did all the, cause I had to do most of the copy fitting, after Chris had developed the first three volumes.
Yeah.
So I was like, oh wait, I really want to change this name, now. I've got to make a note for myself to, in copy fitting, kind of redevelop this name or this one section or this sort of dangling plot line that I didn't realize was dangling until I got to volume four.
I just want to know, I have realized there is a couple of sentences in Fly, Fear, Die volume one, which are factually incorrect.
Ah.
They say something which contradicts the rules of the core rulebook.
Oh, okay. Well, shit. It'll happen. It'll happen.
I fixed it for volume two.
Okay, good.
Same issue happened in volume two, and there it's correct.
All right. Well, but yeah, you're learning. That's important.
Someone's gonna find it, and I've already composed the "Buck stops here" message in my head, where I'm gonna say, "I'm the developer. This is my responsibility, but it's easily fixed. And here's what you do."
Yeah, I've left off sections of stat blocks at some point. I think there's a creature in the back of the Attack on Swarm Alien archive that doesn't have it's statistics or something. It's something stupid that all, like, so many eyes on this book, one of us should have caught it, but it all just sort of, you know, went past us. And so, you know, you just go on, and people ask that question on forums, you just like, or in the product thread, you're like, hey y'all, I just noticed this is wrong, here's what it should be, sorry. And
Yeah.
People are usually fine about it.
Many people, I don't think, realize how many sets of eyes look at every one of these products, because, I mean, completely aside from it, in this case, for like, let's say, Waking the World Seed.
Yeah.
Yourself, of course, and Rob. But then also at least two and maybe four different editors.
Mm-hmm.
And then it goes, and then copy, and then the art. And then there's a approvals page. So you and our managing editor, Judy, and Rob, and
Eric takes a look at everything, but I don't think he doesn't read it word for word.
Yeah.
Also, a lot of people. I was saying, say with Rob, doesn't read an adventure word by word once it's been laid out or whatever, but he will look over and just sort of notice if there's any glaring errors. That's the approval page. It's just sort of, hopefully at that point, our errors are only glaring.
Hopefully.
And there are no errors at all, actually.
Hopefully. Well, so what's next after Waking the World Seed?
The second volume is the Starstone Blockade, and that's when what's being called the Devastation Arc is sort of like, it's not the name of the actual ship. It's actually just called Arc Prime. Comes in and shuts off the Starstone Reactor, which is the magical reactor at the heart of Absalom Station that powers everything, which no one kind of understands how it works or even how to fix it. So that's unfortunate. And that is the PCs have to basically take care of all the problems that occur when that happens.
When the Starstone gets shut off, does that negate Absalom Station's drift navigation advantage?
Yeah. Yeah, it does.
That's awesome.
Which is why it's important to turn it back on. Because help cannot come as fast as it normally could come. So that's the whole thing. Yeah, that's just sort of like, and that's got all sorts of things, like we mentioned, an angel on a motorcycle, some devils, some a giant park, some Islanti spies, a thing from beyond time. It's got everything.
And the spies, I remember, that's a drop it. You tried to sort of seed the whole adventure path with Fallout to our other adventure path.
Essentially, yeah. There's a little bit here and there about, you know, the whole thing is basically a kind of a pseudo sequel to Dead Sons, in that the this, here's the spoiler, is that, and I think you probably know this if you looked at any of the product pages, that the ancient race that built the Stellar Degenerator, the massive super weapon that is at the end of Dead Suns, is the race that builds Arc Prime and is fought a long extinct, but has actually been in, so part of it has been in hibernation for the millennia, sort of drifting through its own hyperspace until it finds a sort of signal that the PCs accidentally turn on, and brings it to the Pack World, a great place to call home.
And these are the Civ.
The Civ, yes. That was to talk about that real quick. We didn't know what they look like until we sat down and decided to make decide what they look like. I mean, one of them, they're evil through and through, so we had to make them look real creepy and evil. Rob and I just sort of that was another long session or two of just hashing out, what does it look like? Let's get this. And we basically grabbed a whole bunch of different animal pictures and other close-ups of microscopic animals and been like, okay, all of that mushed together. And gave it to one of our artists, in-house artist Ken Hamilton, to be like, make concept art for this. And he knocked it out of the park, too. That's another one. It's like, this, I guess. I'm not an artist. Make it look cool. And an artist makes it look cool. And it's just like, wow. So when the people get to see those terrible, terrible sieves,
he actually did such a fantastic job that other artists have a hard time.
Maybe. Yeah. I mean, a little bit, it's hard to follow Kent. Let's just say that. It's definitely a challenge. And that's that you'll get to know more about the Civs in volume 3, Dominion's End by Ron Lundeen, where you're on the Arc Prime and dealing it from within. And all of the things that happen there. There's a colony of indoctrinated moon giants and robots galore and awakened Civ super soldiers and some other crazy creatures from past alien archives.
The Civ have all kinds of crazy technology that's unique to them.
Yeah.
A lot of time on Rel State and what all
yes. that means. What that means, you'll find out in that volume.
Yeah.
Yeah.
When I said what's after Rick Wayne Wilson, what I really meant is what's after Devastation Arc? Like
Fly Free or Die is after Devastation Arc, my friend.
That's a dumb question. I guess I should. What's next? you helped with all the back matter articles and all of that.
Mm-hmm.
So you came up with the idea of the five jobs.
Yes.
One session, two-page adventures.
Yeah.
Yeah, which I love because that creates a lot of new utility for those adventures, for those books. Like you can go back to that book years from now
and
that one night adventure and just drop it into your campaign and get something to do.
As something that I would always do with, especially like Dungeon Magazine and earlier episodes of volumes of Pathfinder, would be like, I'm running in my own campaign, but I don't know what to do. I'll just take this adventure. I was running a campaign in a different setting, a different published setting, but I would be taking dungeon articles and just being like, well, this is here in this setting and it's a dungeon that has these puzzles in it. Great. Yeah. Or they have to go talk to the Yeti people. Hooray. not the Yeti people, the Yak people.
Yeah. I remember the Yak people. Yeah.
All
right. So, but we actually can't, we have not been clear to talk about.
We're going to probably hear what that's coming after Fly Free or Die at PAX Unplugged, which is in the fall, I think.
Is you are going to love it. It's really, really exciting.
Yep.
It's something we've been talking about doing for a very long time.
Yeah, it's another thing that people, don't get me wrong, I am shameless. I will give people what they ask for. If they ask for it enough, I'll be like, yeah, okay, we'll do that. We didn't do it sooner because we just didn't have the right story. And now we do.
So So stay tuned and we'll be able to talk about, we'll have you back on when we can talk about that. I'd love to have you back on. Thank you so much for coming on the show and giving me an hour.
Thanks for having me.
I miss your smiling face.
I'm crazy. My eyes. What?
Maybe not when you do that.
Everyone hates my face. It's fine.
Actually, I just realized I don't get I haven't been able to look at the secret ghost lab all this time.
Oh, right. Yeah, that's when I stream from my work computer, which is a different part of the very small apartment.
The secret ghost lab. Well, I would ask questions about the secret ghost lab, but I know what the secret means, unlike other people
who continually probe and prod. You're not cleared. You're not cleared to know what's in the ghost lab.
Well, all right. So thanks again, everybody. Thanks for watching. And we're gonna post Keeley's Twitter handle in the for this show. So if you have questions that he may or may not answer, post them in there. And we'll see you next time. Thanks, guys.
Bye.